You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Mike O'Hanlon at Brookings, and I'm honored to be here with my good buddy and colleague Bill Galston talking about sequestration. And today is 4 days from when we anticipate it will begin. March 1st is coming right up. And Bill, nice to be up here with you.
Well, it's good to be here with you, Michael. And we are 4 days out, and sometimes that's an eternity in American politics, but not this time. I think it's almost certain there's going to be a lot of shadow boxing over the next 96 hours leading to the implementation of what is called sequestration in plain English across the board budget cuts as of the beginning of next month. This represents, in my judgment, a massive failure, the latest example of governance failure in Washington, D.C. Sequestration was designed never to go into effect. It was designed to be such stupid policy that surely the two political parties would get together on something better. But instead, they haven't. And I guess the biggest consequences are going to be felt on the defense side.
If I could ask you, I know we both have views on some of the substance, and we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But I want to ask you who's at fault. And it's not just to play the blame game and to voice and vent frustrations. It's because presumably, as the country wrestles with this question, we will figure out which party to the debate is going to have to perhaps concede a little bit more than the other. At least it strikes me, and you can correct me here in a second if I'm wrong, but that's sort of the way people are approaching this. Both sides have said, I've got a strong view on how I won't do a deal to avert sequestration. The Democrats won't apparently touch Social Security reform, for example, and they insist on some revenue increases. Republicans refuse to consider that, feeling they've already done enough on the January 1st deal, which increased taxes modestly over the next 10 years. Can you say that either side is to blame? I guess the public's going to have the verdict on this to some extent, and people will watch public opinion polls to see which side has to reconsider its view. But can you say anything now about how to interpret who's more at fault and who got us into this mess, besides just sort of Washington broadly defined?
Well, if I wanted to be combative, I might say that the American people should begin by looking in the mirror. They chose to retain divided government. They institutionalized the debate between the Democratic Party's strategy for dealing with the budget and the Republican Party's strategy for dealing with the budget. And now, inevitably, we're having the debate with the House Republicans at one pole and the administration at the other, and the Senate Democrats somewhere in the middle. You could argue, if you wanted to go back in history, that Republican intransigence over the debt ceiling back in 2011 contributed mightily to sequestration coming into being. On the other hand, it's now reasonably well established that it was senior administration officials led by the man who's probably going to be the next Treasury Secretary of the United States who actually came up with the sequestration idea. So that's not a softball question. I really don't know how to assign blame. There's plenty of blame to go around is my bottom line judgment.
And one more thing, and the reason why I find this helpful is that it helps me think about how do you get out of the mess? Because, again, we're going to have some kind of a verdict, presumably, on who got us into this, or at least whose position needs to be more rethought to get us out of it. At least that's one possible interpretation. So one more question in the same vein would be, was it a mistake to do the January 1st deal? Because what the January 1st deal seems to have done is to make everyone feel frustrated. Obama felt that he didn't get enough revenue increase, but he had to do something to avert an immediate fiscal cliff. The Republicans felt they had already done a fiscal deal that included tax increases, and they weren't going to do it again. Even approving a modest increase for them ran perilously close to violating their pledge never to allow tax increases. So both sides got, in a sense, frustrated and took an interpretation of that January 1st deal that almost made it inevitable, it now seems, that we were going to have this showdown 2 months later. Was it a mistake to disentangle the revenue piece on January 1st from the spending piece on March 1st?
In my judgment, yes, it was. And this is a pretty good example of why some people have been arguing for years now that a large agreement is going to be easier than a series of smaller agreements. Because if you have one large agreement with everything on the table, or one large discussion with everything on the table, you can do all of the trade-offs simultaneously or in real time. If you do it sequentially, then you narrow the options every time you do an incremental deal. And it is perfectly correct that the Republicans now feel that on the revenue side, they already gave it the office. They don't see why they had to have to do it again. It's also correct that the revenue that they ended up giving at the office was less than they'd indicated that they were previously willing to give. But from a political standpoint, it's not the size of the revenue, but the number of times you have to vote for a tax increase that's important for Republicans. And for many of them, one vote for a tax increase is one too many, and they're certainly not going to do it again. I find it difficult to believe that the administration is going to be happy with an all-cut strategy, any kind of all-cut strategy, to replace sequestration.
It seems to me that a good way for our conversation now to conclude, or have a couple more phases as we wrap up, is to first maybe each of us talk about what concerns us most in the cuts that are happening with sequestration, which particular effects in the course of the next few weeks will be most problematic. And then maybe to look to prospects for a deal, recognizing that at some point our predictions will be overtaken by events. But if we could each maybe voice a couple of concerns, I've got a couple on the defense side, you may as well. But could I ask you to begin with a couple of your concerns about where sequestration hits the domestic discretionary accounts, as they're called, where you think we will suffer most or see the greatest pain or inconvenience in the coming weeks?
Well, first of all, there's a timing question, because it's not at all clear that the greatest pain and inconvenience will be felt in the next few weeks. It's going to take time to implement all of this. It's also the case that the impact on actual government outlays is going to be smaller at the beginning than the impact on the ability of the government to make future commitments. And so a lot of people are now beginning to worry about the dog that didn't bark scenario. And having said that, I think it's very unfortunate that a number of the cuts are going to fall on the backs of low-income and disadvantaged people. The argument for throwing young kids out of Head Start, the moral argument and even the pragmatic argument, in my judgment, is extremely weak. And I could list a number of low-income programs that were not exempted from the sequester. Some were, but many were not. And that's what troubles me the most, that in these times, it seems to me that the focus should be on people who can really afford to give back something for their country and not on people who have so little in the first place.
Are you at least partially relieved that sequestration doesn't really hit, let's say, the entitlement accounts with, for example, Medicaid, as I understand it, is not taking a big hit, which is largely targeted on lower-income Americans. Is that a partial solace for you in this whole scheme?
It's a partial mitigation, but what that means is that with that pot of dollars to be cut now has to be distributed among fewer discretionary domestic programs, and a lot of the low-income programs that weren't exempted from the sequester are going to be hit pretty hard. But it seems to me, over to you, Mike, that the most important impact is going to be on the defense side.
You know, and it's a fascinating question, and I've been trying to sort out what I think is most consequential, because we've seen in the last couple of weeks the Joint Chiefs go up to the Hill in one last-ditch effort convened by the Senate Armed Services Committee to try to point out the downsides of sequestration. When you read through their testimonies, I think you get three or four different categories of problems, and they frankly didn't do a great job of disentangling or deconflating the different problems. One is where you have some sort of nuisance effects and things that are not nice for the people that are directly affected. For example, certain numbers of contractors can't be hired to paint buildings at certain bases around the country. Doesn't matter that much if the bases are, you know, the barracks are painted this year, next year, the year after, but there's no particular benefit to the delay and disruption, and it's a hit to the pocketbooks of people who can't work for DOD. The civilians who work for the Department of Defense is a second category. These people are going to take it pretty hard. The furlough issue just bothers me because, you know, I live in Washington. I know a lot of civilians who work for DOD and other agencies. And this doesn't even quite get to the national security question. It gets to the fairness question. DOD civilians are people too, and they're great patriots too. And I don't see why they're going to get 20% pay cuts for the rest of the year to the extent this potentially leads to that kind of a furloughing system. It just strikes me as unfair. As you now start to look at direct national security implications, I'm not a big, I'm not hugely concerned about the fact that the Harry S. Truman aircraft carrier couldn't go to the Persian Gulf a couple weeks ago because they didn't think there was money to do it. If we have a real crisis, if we really need to send it, we still can. I'm not overly concerned that pilots won't be able to get every flying hour that was previously scheduled for training this summer, because the ones who are deployed near or in Afghanistan or supporting that operation will have their funds and their money, and the troops in Afghanistan will have theirs, and all military personnel, of course, will get their salaries at the full level. So when General Odierno was here at the middle of February, he talked about how he's not going to be able to get the follow-on forces properly prepared for Afghanistan, which means in 2014 he could have a conundrum. Do I leave the same people who were already there longer than originally intended, or do I send over replacements who are not fully trained? That's a good way, I think, to highlight some of the dilemma. But over the longer term, I think what worries me most is the sheer magnitude of the cuts. I am not a proponent of $500 billion more in 10-year defense cuts. So there's a huge inefficiency with sequestration. Most of it can be dealt with. Most of it is not going to be a risk to our superpower capability, no matter what some of the Joint Chiefs have sometimes said. We'll be able to make up for whatever backlogs in equipment repair and other things we develop over these next few weeks or months. But I just don't see the benefit. It seems hugely disruptive and inefficient for no good reason. But on top of that, the magnitude of the 10-year cuts, if something like this stays in place, strike me as imprudent. And it would take a longer conversation to go through the full set of reasons, but I'll just give you one example. When I try to think about what kinds of cuts need to be made to get us to $500 billion more in 10-year defense cuts, I look at military pay, and I say we have to do a lot more than just retirement reform, a lot more than just asking military families to pay a more typical premium for their health care benefits, more like the rest of America. I think we have to actually cut base pay in real terms. We have to maybe freeze it and no adjustment for inflation for a five-year period. Something like that is the only way to get to the kind of numbers that I think are going to be needed for that level of cut. I'll give one more example, I guess, is appropriate at a strategic level. The Army is already downsizing, as it should, and it can downsize a bit more. But if you do sequestration, I think you have to cut the active duty Army down to about 400,000 troops or fewer, which, to put it in perspective, is enough to do one big war plus one little thing. But what if the world surprises you, like it did 12 years ago? What if we wind up in a major conflagration somehow in North Korea, which we certainly don't anticipate or want, but it could happen. It's not out of the question. And at the same time, we've already decided to commit to a multinational stabilization mission in Syria, or we're still in Afghanistan. An army of 400,000 probably can't handle that combination. And so I think at a strategic level, you're gambling against fate in a way that I'm not comfortable with. Now, this is ultimately a hypothetical, theoretical question, because you gotta, no matter what, postulate scenarios that may or may not ever play out. And no one can really say in advance what's the proper level of prudence. But as I look around the world at the different contingencies I could imagine, taking the Army down to 400,000 looks to me like it's too little, because recent history would suggest we often are doing more than one substantial thing at a time.
Well, one question that interests me from the governance and political perspective is why this is on the verge of happening, particularly as regards the defense budget. A very significant political shift is now occurring before our eyes. The bastion of support for the defense budget used to be on the conservative side of the political spectrum, which is not to say that liberals and Democrats were indifferent to the defense budget, but by and large, defense was considered all but sacrosanct among conservatives. Now suddenly you have a new generation of conservatives more interested in fiscal questions than in defense, more averse to increases in taxes than they are to cuts in defense. That is the new center of gravity, particularly in the House of Representatives. The Senate may be different, but right now, conservatives in the House of Representatives are opting for defense cuts rather than even loophole closings as a way of raising additional revenues that could be funneled into the Defense Department. And if that's the harbinger of the future of the fiscal debate and fiscal policy direction in the United States, then the Pentagon could be in for a long, lean period because the fiscal problem isn't going away anytime soon.
It's a great point, and I've been struck by the same thing. I guess one thing I would add, though, is that there are a couple of additional issues internationally that I know are on your mind, and they're on my mind, too, that we haven't even mentioned yet. The rise of China, the potential for war against Iran, which is probably a 50-50 proposition if you look at President Obama's rhetoric and Iran's nuclear program. And it'll be interesting to see if this new indifference to defense spending, if I can overstate for the sake of effect, if this really survives a possible U.S. preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear facilities, or alternatively, in 5 years, we see that China's military budget starts to appear impressively close to our own when you graph them both on the same sheet of paper. And by 2020, they could begin to converge. And I think that that may not be a horrible thing if we can manage our relationship well with China. But right now, it looks as if China's feeling fairly assertive and feeling a little bit of its oats as a result of its greater strength. And I wonder if American politics, when we stare at those problems more, will have some second thoughts about defense cuts. And one more very sort of meat and potatoes way to think about it. Military planners, if you ask them to absorb $500 billion more in defense cuts over 10 years, the way sequestration would require, or the way our own colleague Alice Rivlin with her plans that she's been part of would require, you're going to have to cut military compensation substantially. And all for a political system that refuses to even slightly adjust the cost of living formula for Social Security recipients. Or to put it more bluntly, we are saying that most of us who stayed home and didn't fight these wars, we get to keep every single dime of projected Social Security. So, and at the same time, military families will actually take not just adjustments in their inflation formula, but real cuts in their compensation in a sustained, protracted way across all areas of compensation. And that's now our area, that's all, now our concept of fairness. It'll be interesting to see how this debate plays out. I think there are some areas of military compensation that are too high. So don't get me wrong. I think there's room for reform. But I'm struck that we can't even, the way some economists would advocate, we can't even take that cost of living formula down by 0.3% of a point per year, which a lot of economists say would make it more accurate. And yet we are willing to talk about substantial real cuts in military pay.
Well, we began with a prediction, so let me end with another one. We may have sequestration for a month or a few months or even a year. We are not going to have sequestration for 10 years because it is already distorting policy so much, not only in defense, but in other areas, that these cuts are inevitably going to be folded into a broader conversation about our fiscal future. And if they force that conversation to proceed more quickly than they would otherwise, then maybe in an entirely unintentional way, it will turn out to be a good thing. Sometime in the next month, the Congress is going to have to figure out how to fund the federal government for the remainder of this fiscal year because its budget, its temporary budget, runs out on March 27th. So sequestration is already being seen in the framework of that medium-term discussion. I think inevitably it will be seen in a broader context of the president's budget, which is very late this year. It's going to be probably close to a month beyond the point that it's legally required to be delivered to the Congress. But we are going to have to get to that broader conversation, and I think that sequestration is going to turn out to be a part of that conversation, but unless we're very unlikely, not the totality of it.
Well, I think that's a great place to start, and you even managed to find a hopeful way to finish. So while the overall gist of this conversation has not been all that happy, I want to congratulate you for finding a silver lining. It's nice speaking with you.
You too, Mike.